It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll head out to the grill for some tasty marinades, along with fun drinks to sip while we're tending that barbecue.
But first, President Obama announced last night that he had authorized limited airstrikes on Islamic militants in Iraq.
The president said that American plans are also dropping aid and supplies to religious minorities who are fleeing the Muslim extremist group, the Islamic State, also known as ISIS.
So is the U.S. getting dragged into another war in the Mideast? And just how effective can the U.S. be in this conflict? With us now is Stephen David, professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome to Central Time, Stephen.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, I want to back up a few days and talk about the choices that were facing the president. Did he have any good ones?
No. Look, Obama was elected in large part getting us out of Iraq and Afghanistan. And to a large extent, he's done that. And so it must have been very difficult for him to be dragged back in.
And so as we heard his announcement last night, I think one of the stories I read, he was very somber, which I would expect. He did not, and somebody else, there was some analysis that said nobody could accuse him of being enthusiastic about this. Is that the way you see it?
Sure. I mean, he did not want to put Americans in harm's way back in Iraq. I think it's the last thing he wanted to do. And while he is reaffirmed that we're not going to have boots on the ground, I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, well, one thing can lead to another, and let's say the airstrikes are not effective in stopping ISIS. What's next? And are we going to get back into this mess despite our best intentions?
And so, as I understand it, there are two issues here, or two courses of action, the humanitarian aid and then the airstrikes. We've already seen a couple rounds of airstrikes and some humanitarian aid being delivered. Are these sort of part of the same larger strategy? Talk a little bit about not the airstrikes just yet, but the humanitarian aid aspect of it, because this is an important element. The U.S. has had this opportunity to provide humanitarian aid in other countries before. Why Iraq? Why now?
Well, a lot of things have come together. First, the Yazidi and Christian communities that are being targeted by an especially brutal, horrific group, ISIS or the Islamic State. I mean, these guys are running through northern Iraq and Syria. They're coming into towns, and anyone who doesn't adopt their version of Islam has a choice. They either have a forced conversion, well, they're killed, and sometimes they agree to convert, and they're killed anyway. And, you know, the word genocide is often thrown around loosely where it doesn't belong. But much of what's going on here is genocidal. I mean, especially with the Yazidi community, ISIS really wants to wipe these people out. And it wants to create this caliphate, this Islamic State across Iraq and Syria, and further, if it can so achieve, throughout the Middle East, where minorities and even Muslims who don't adhere to their branch of Islam have no place. And so you have these people who are running away. They're on this mountaintop. They're dying of hunger and thirst. Children are dying. To turn a blind eye to that when America might be able to stop it, that's asking an awful lot.
And then at the same time, we've got the airstrikes. And how do you go about, if you are the president, if you are the Iraqis, measuring the success of those? Do those areas actually, do we turn back the ISIS forces? Do we just stop them? Do we what?
My sense is, at least initially, the purpose of the airstrikes is simply to provide cover for the cargo planes that are dropping the humanitarian assistance. The cargo planes fly very low, they don't go very quickly, and they're very vulnerable to ground fire from the ISIS forces. So by having suppressing fire from the F-18s, the planes themselves are protected. A more ambitious goal would be to push ISIS back. And I don't think that can be done through the air. Certainly, I think the airstrikes can help. but you need a determined and skilled ground component. And so far, we don't have that. I mean, the Iraqi army turned out to be a joke. I mean, despite the billions of dollars and efforts and blood we poured into that institution, it just broke and ran. The hope and expectation was that the Kurds would do better. The Peshmerga forces were seen to be much tougher and more resolute. But they've been overwhelmed also, probably because they've been outgunned. A lot of the ISIS forces have taken equipment that America supplied to the Iraqi army and has turned it against the Kurds, who are simply outgunned in terms of what they're up against. So I think has to happen now, and what I guess will happen, is that America will supply far more military aid to the Kurds. We didn't do this before because we felt we were interfering in the sovereign authority of Iraq. You know, Kurdistan is nominally part of the greater Iraqi state. If we give them weapons, they might be using them against the Iraqis or using them to create an independent Kurdish state, which can cause instability elsewhere. So we held back. But now I think we're not going to hold back much more. They're the one force, perhaps with the remnants of the Iraqi army, that can stop these guys.
And the president last night did seem to draw a line when he said there's no American military solution to this, meaning, I presume, boots on the ground. Is that a line he's going to be able to hold to? I mean, politically, it sure is one I imagine he wants to.
I think despite the horrendous nature of this situation, I think it would be very, very difficult for Obama to put large numbers of American troops back in Iraq. Now, bear in mind, we've already reinserted several hundred advisors back in Iraq, and my guess is that was difficult for him to do also. But the notion of a large-scale intervention along the lines of the Iraqi war, I don't think we're prepared to do that, no.
And you alluded earlier to the idea of a slippery slope. How big of a possibility is that? What should people be looking for if they want to avoid that?
Well, I guess the red line for Obama would probably be a large-scale intervention of American forces. I don't think he or the American people are prepared to do that. That said, there are a lot of other things we can do. We can work with regional allies. Again, we can arm the Kurds. We can provide military advisors. We can have more robust airstrikes. But at the end of the day, if it requires a large-scale intervention by American forces, I think that's not a bridge he's prepared to cross. And that must be difficult for him, too. I mean, on the one hand, he doesn't want to put American forces there. On the other hand, again, it's hard to turn a blind eye to these horrific massacres that are occurring. I mean, this group is supposedly even too brutal for al-Qaeda. And the strategic significance of ISIS taking over large portions of the Middle East are devastating. You know, look, a lot of attention has been focused on the Israeli war with Gaza, and I don't mean to minimize the horror and suffering of the people in Gaza. But strategically, this is a much bigger deal because you're talking about a group that can take over the heartland of the Middle East that's dedicated to the most extreme form of Islamic terrorism. That's something the United States or pretty much any other reasonable country does not want to see happen.
So given all of that, did the president really have the option of doing nothing, of just looking at all these things and saying, you know, now is not the time to get involved?
He did. I mean, you always have that option with a humanitarian affair. Look, by some estimates, 4 million people have died in the civil war in Congo, and the United States is not involved, nor are there efforts to make us involved. In Somalia in 1994, in Rwanda in 1994, 800,000 people were massacred, and the United States did nothing, and the world continued to spin. Right now, with the world's attention on the Middle East, maybe this is too difficult to ignore. And, you know, I have to say I'm conflicted myself. I don't want to see another American intervention in the Middle East. but it's gut-wrenching to see what these people are doing. So did Obama have an option? Yes. I mean, he could have simply said, this is not our fight. We're going to evacuate the American personnel in Kurdistan, and they've got to work it out themselves. And I suspect a fair number of the American people maybe would go along with that. Perhaps the fact that Christian communities are being targeted and the Pope is involved has made this kind of avoidance more difficult. But in the end of the day, if he chose to turn a blind eye, he could have.
Well, that's a good place to leave it. Thanks so much for being with us today, Stephen.
It's my pleasure.
We've been talking with Stephen David, a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. The Packers preseason starts tomorrow, meaning it's time to kick up our grilling to the next level. On today's edition of Food Friday, our guest brings a few interesting twists to the traditional barbecue marinades.
And since marinating takes time, why not mix up some interesting summer beverages to keep you company?
Here to help us with both is Food Friday guest Ian Knauer. He's a farm-to-table chef and host of the PBS series The Farm, and he has a cookbook out by that name. Ian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Always good to be here.
Well, let's start with marinades. Before we get into the particular suggestions you have, how important is marinade to a good barbecue?
Well, it all depends on what you're cooking. If you are cooking a really flavorful, fatty steak, then I wouldn't marinate it at all. You know, something like a ribeye or even a skirt steak, just need some salt and pepper before you throw it on the grill. So it depends on what you're cooking, you know, to sort of vaguely avoid your question there.
Well, but for drier stuff, like a chicken breast, not a lot of fat there. I feel like if I don't marinate that, I've got bad chicken in the offing.
Well, not necessarily bad, but yeah, you're right. Marinating is a really easy way to get a lot of flavor into a cut of meat that might have a little less fat in it, like a chicken breast, or it might be a little bit tougher, like maybe like a sirloin steak, for instance. So sirloin steaks can be really excellent on the grill, but they need a little time to sort of relax, and there are certain ingredients that help them do that. Acid is one, salt is another, and both acid and salt are very common ingredients in most marinades. So you're basically kind of pre-cooking your meat for a tougher cut when you're marinating it.
So let's talk about some specific marinades. This one caught my eye, Mojo marinade. What exactly is that all about?
Well, actually, I'm going to call it Mojo from now on. It's pronounced Mojo.
Okay, well, okay. Good for me.
I was saying Mojo too, or really like Mojito maybe. Mojo.
Exactly.
Okay.
I like Mojo.
And similar. Well, I like Mojo better too. Yeah, similar to a Mojito. It often has lime juice in it. Now, this one that I think I sent you has lime juice and orange juice, and again, that's where your acid is. So that acid is going to work on the meat to tenderize it as it's marinating before you put it on the grill. So this one has the orange juice, the lime juice. It's got some garlic in there, which, of course, adds a ton of flavor, and some fresh cilantro. So it's a really nice, fresh, kind of bright marinade for summer grilling.
It sounds like it would be great with, like, a pork.
Pork is perfect for that. In fact, most commonly it's used with pork. But it's also great with chicken. It's great with steak as well. I use it on just about everything.
Yeah, are a lot of marinades multilingual like that? You could translate them into different kinds of meat?
They are, yeah. And you know, multilingual is sort of an interesting word to use because a lot of marinades come from different places in the world where the population might not have access to more expensive cuts of meat.
Oh.
Therefore, they have to come up with ways to tenderize them, and so they'll use these marinades. Mojo is a really good example. That's a South American marinade where you could take a tougher cut of pork or steak and tenderize it with a marinade.
And now for a marinade basic, how long, you know, do we take? I've had some people, you know, we 24 hours. Other people want to press it a little more, less than that. What's a good kind of rule of thumb?
Well, I hate to disappoint you, but the answer is it all depends.
You're worse than a politician, Ian.
Exactly. Depends on how big your cut of meat is. So, you know, we're talking about pork. If you want to marinate a whole pork shoulder, like a pork butt, mm-hmm. which can be really amazing on the grill, you know, you cook it for hours until it falls off the bone, you would want to marinate that at least 24 hours because it's such a big, thick cut of meat. But if you're dealing with something that's thinner, you know, or like kebabs, you know, mm-hmm. small cubes of meat, you can really actually get away with an hour or two beforehand. So anywhere between those is the answer. And I know that that doesn't give you a rule of thumb at all. But that's the honest answer.
Hey, barbecuing is an art, not a science. Well, let's move on to another marinade. You gave us one with an Asian twist for tuna with a miso glaze. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so miso is a really interesting ingredient. And you can get it at a lot of supermarkets now in the refrigerator section. It's a fermented soy paste. So it's kind of like soy sauce in a way. It comes from a soybean. It was made in a very different process. And because it's fermented, it's basically alive. So it's kind of like a culture, like yogurt, for instance. And because it is what it is, it acts to tenderize meat. There's also a fair amount of salt in it. So it acts as a really good tenderizer and also a flavor booster. There's a ton of umami in this stuff. So anything that you put it on is going to taste better. Not necessarily taste like miso, but your steak will taste steakier, for instance.
You had Gene at fermented soy paste.
Actually, you did have me at fermented. So there's another more traditional one here that I'm looking at that includes soy sauce and vinegar and maple syrup with that sweet component to it.
Yeah, this is a really super simple marinade. It's one that I go to all the time because I always have the ingredients right in my kitchen. You got soy sauce. It's equal parts soy sauce, maple syrup, and balsamic vinegar. So you have a salty element, a sweet element, and an acidic element, and they work together really harmoniously. I like to cook that with steak a lot because it has a lot of flavor to it. But again, it's one of those that goes with just about anything. So if you've got pork or if you've got chicken, it's really good with all of those choices.
And before we move on to beverages, the food safety people we have on from time to time will want us to say, once you've used the marinade on the raw meat, don't put it back on the cooked meat. Am I right?
Well, that's right. You can reuse it, but you want to put it in a saucepan and bring it up to a boil. And that way it'll be safe, and you'll kill anything that might be lurking in there. So you don't necessarily have to throw it away, but you do want to bring it up to a boil just to make sure that you're safe.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's move on to beverages and don't just drink that marinade. A lot of people here, of course, will just drink beer while they're grilling. Sure. You've got a couple fun non-alcoholic grilling recommendations. One with cantaloupe.
Yeah, so melon is one of my favorite things to drink in the summer. If you get a really nice cantaloupe, you could do this with honeydew or watermelon also. Cut it into cubes, stick it in the blender with just a little bit of sugar and maybe a cucumber or some mint, and whiz it up until it's a liquid. You don't even need to strain it, and it makes for just an unbelievably refreshing summer drink. A really fun thing to do is to cut that melon up into cubes and stick the cubes in the freezer until they're solid. And then blend that. You end up with a frozen version,
nice.
Like a frozen margarita without the booze. And, of course, you can always add the booze if you want. I am quite fond to put rum in my cantaloupe cocktails.
That sounds really good.
That does sound really good. Now, one of the prettier drinks that we've seen is the Green Lantern. It is gorgeous, I have to say. And listeners can see it if it's up on our Facebook page. Tell us what's in it. What makes it so pretty?
Well, the thing that makes the Green Lantern so pretty is actually the parsley. And before you decide to change the channel.
Yeah, exactly.
Parsley is a really great addition to a drink, you know, and green juices have become really popular all over the country. This is kind of in that vein. So you're blending up parsley. I think there's some lime juice in there, a little bit of sugar. I like to then strain that and top it off with some seltzer water. It's a really great breakfast drink, but also if you want to have that as a cocktail, gin is a really nice addition to that too.
All right. Well, what are your weekend grilling plans? I know you'll be watching the Packers game tomorrow night, Ian.
I sure will be out here on the East Coast. I'm gonna have a really fun weekend. Tomorrow I'm having a gardening workshop at my cooking school, and we're going to harvest everything, and then we're going to grill it for dinner. So I'm excited for that.
That is straight farm to grill to table. Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
That's Chef Ian Knauer, host of a new PBS series. It's called The Farm. He's got a cookbook by the same name. We've got a couple of the recipes we've talked about today over at the Central Time Facebook page, including the Green Lantern. And I think it's worth a look at the picture, too. It's a drink that's fun to look at as well, I imagine, to drink. I haven't tried it myself.
And as far as I'm concerned, it is the Mojo Mojo.
Mojo.
I renamed it that way.
Wow.
Yeah, you like that?
Yeah.
For the marinade?
Yeah, bring that in next time, Gene.
All right. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm filling in today for Veronica Rickert.
It's our final day of candidate forums here on Central Time. All week we've been talking with the primary contestants in a variety of races across the state. Today we turn to the race for lieutenant governor. The office is currently held by Republican Rebecca Clayfish. She's up for re-election but doesn't have a primary opponent. There are two Democrats looking for the chance to challenge her, and we'll talk with both over the next hour. We'll start with John Lehman. He's a Democratic state senator who represents Wisconsin's 21st Senate district. Senator Lehman, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
So first, the basics. Why are you running for lieutenant governor of Wisconsin?
Well, I looked at the race last fall and saw the developing race and thought that perhaps a senator from southeastern Wisconsin could add value to the ticket. At the time, it was Kathleen Vinehout and Mary Burke both talking seriously about running. Kathleen had to back out because of her automobile injury. And then I had a chance to sit down with Mary Burke and see the agenda that she's running under. And actually, you know, I had known her when she was Secretary of Commerce, but really had a chance to talk to her about what she'd like to do as governor, and I got pretty excited about it.
Now, voters might remember that you unseated State Senator Van Wongard in a recall election in 2012. Why give up that Senate seat where maybe you already have more power to influence policy than you would as lieutenant governor?
Well, the Senate seat I was elected to is gone. You know, the Republicans drew it to become a Republican district. I think it's about 58% Republican in Western Racine and Kenosha County. So I had, you know, I had been defeated once. I'd retired. I came back in the only successful recall in 2012. And then, you know, I thought, well, maybe I should be retiring. But this opportunity to run for lieutenant governor, I think, is a good fit for me. I believe very strongly that, and the polls show it already, that Mary Burke has a wonderful chance of running. So I thought I would see what I could do to add some value to that ticket.
Can you tell us a little more about your background and why it makes you well-suited to run for lieutenant governor?
Yeah, I'm a former school teacher. You know, over 20 years in the classroom, high school economics and world history teacher. But then I went in the legislature in 1996 and served a decade in the assembly before I went over to the Senate. Chaired the Senate Education Committee, chaired the Senate Democratic Caucus, two terms serving on Joint Finance Committee. So I kind of know my way around the legislature a little bit, and I think people respect that. I'm getting a lot of support all around the state.
So that recall election that brought you back into office was largely spurred by anger over Act 10, the budget repair bill that changed collective bargaining for public employees. As lieutenant governor, would you and your Democratic running mates fight against that law?
Well, you have heard, I'm sure, Mary Burke talk about Act 10 and how the Walker administration went way too far. I think we had a lot of the bargaining units willing to talk seriously on retirement contributions and health care contributions, but Act 10 went a lot further than that. It's the disrespect and the going so far with Act 10. I think that shocked everybody. You remember it was just a little budget repair bill. It usually was not controversial. Walker came right out of the chute and just tried to rip public employees and created the division in the state that is really something that's not typical if you look at our long Wisconsin history, and we just think we could do so much better.
The governor and his supporters have made the case that, unpopular though it was with the public employees, in large part it has worked as designed. It's helping local governments, school districts save money.
Yeah, you have heard, you know, Walker's argument was we gave school districts the tools. Well, the tools were making, you know, very large contributions from the public employees and taking just fair bargaining rights away from those employees. I don't think if you go around the state with what Walker has done to education, you can say that things are just fine. You know, what you're looking at is the largest defunding of education we've had in our history, and you're looking at developing two separate and unequal systems. If you look at the voucher schools and what they'd like to do with charter schools, you're developing two different systems, sending money into the private areas where people have been paying for decades and decades to have their children go to special schools. Now the taxpayers are supposed to pick up that tab. So I don't think Walker has a leg to stand on it when it comes to fair funding of public education or developing an environment where we can have a good, positive environment and that every child is able to succeed.
Let's get into the role of the lieutenant governor. While it's the second in command, technically, there aren't really that many responsibilities designated to the post. What would you envision your role as lieutenant governor looking like?
Well, you know, the governor, whoever she is or whoever he is, can't be every place at once. And to be on that team and to support the governor's public policy initiatives and support the governor's message around the state is something I really look forward to. A number of months ago, I had a nice conversation with Barb Lawton, who is a longtime lieutenant governor, and she reminded me of what a wonderful opportunity it is for public service to try to get more people involved in the process and to help explain whatever the governor's working at and fight for good public policy initiatives. I look forward to serving with Mary Burke.
The current lieutenant governor, Rebecca Clayfish, is acting in effect as a state job ambassador, traveling around the state and beyond to try to sell employers on Wisconsin, bring businesses across the border over here. Is that a role you'd continue?
I would be happy to do that if the governor asked, but I think Rebecca Clayfish is doing more. If you watch her out-of-state fundraising junkets, if you look at her talking to special interest groups promising to love them more, whatever she's been doing, I don't like the way that the governor and the lieutenant governor have spoken to special interests rather than the general public.
What kind of plans would you call for to try to spur job creation in the state, if not what the current lieutenant governor is doing?
Well, I think that what we've seen with Walker is a kind of a failed top-down, trickle-down jobs kind of plan. And if you look at what WEDEC has done as a public-private partnership, it has not done so well. It has offered tax credits and incentives to friends. And I think that we need to certainly do everything we can to be competitive with other states. But first and foremost, job development, and Mary Burke has talked about this a lot in her Invest for Success plan, job development, especially through the technical schools, focusing on the jobs and opportunities that are there right now, and supporting Wisconsinites as they attempt to expand their businesses.
You've mentioned working with Mary Burke. She does have a primary opponent, Brett Hulsey. Could you see working with either of them?
Well, I think both Mary and I are focused on the November election, and I think as I travel around the state, I don't see folks taking Brett Hulsey as seriously as Mary Burke.
And how would you envision your working relationship with the governor if you are elected?
Well, I think one of the things that I'm known for and one of the things that people appreciate and the reason a number of folks encourage me to run for lieutenant governor is I do have, I think, a history of being able to talk to people on both sides and being able to listen, to deal with complex issues, and to not be a guy who tries to light fires everywhere, but rather a person who tries to put them out and tries to build cooperation among folks. And I could see that as the role I would take. You know, over history, sometimes governors and lieutenant governors get a reputation for not getting along so well. I don't think you'll ever see that between me and Mary Burke.
And you would be, you mentioned working across party lines. There's a good chance that even if Democrats win the governor's office, there would still be a Republican legislature. With your experience in the legislature, and maybe sometimes contentious, including that recall election, do you think you could help bridge the gap between a Democratic executive or Republican legislature?
Well, I wouldn't write off the Senate so quickly. You know, a lot of people are saying we may get, the Democrats may get or may get very close in the Senate. But whatever it is, if we have a divided government, I think that just points everybody towards the middle, and you have to sit down, you have to bargain. And we certainly have strong differences in point of view at times with Republicans. But in a divided government, I think when it's all settled, it's just better for the people of the state of Wisconsin than having the kind of government that we've had that's kind of gone off the rails now with all the Republican agenda that we've seen in the last couple of years.
We're talking with Democratic Lieutenant Governor candidate John Lehman. You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for the candidate, or are you wondering where he stands on an issue? The number is 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret here with Gene Purcell, talking with Democratic Lieutenant Governor candidate John Lehman. He's one of two Democrats running for the office of Lieutenant Governor. If you've got a question for John Lehman or are wondering where he stands on a particular issue, you can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. Senator Lehman, I just wanted to ask you about a couple of the issues that will face the governor in the coming year or two. First of all, health care and how the state interacts with the Affordable Care Act. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we've turned down millions of dollars in federal money in all kinds of way under Walker, I think because he wants to set himself to campaign nationally. But if you look at transportation, health care, any area where he common core state standards and education, he's trying to distance himself from anything the federal government is doing. And that's unfortunate that we allowed politics to get in the way of health care. We could have many more people covered at lower cost if Walker had been more cooperative. And I would expect that if Mary Burke is elected governor, we'll see good cooperation where Wisconsinites will be getting their federal tax dollars back and will be in a cooperative rather than this world that we're in right now of polarization and high levels of politics. I think Mary's a very pragmatic person, and I think she'd look at the bottom line on health care and say, how can we do it better? How can we do it more efficiently and less expensively to the taxpayers of Wisconsin?
Another big issue in the state moving forward, the proposed iron mine in northern Wisconsin. There's been opposition to that, including some Democrats in the state legislature. What do you see going on with that moving forward?
I served on both mining committees, both the one under Cullen before the Republicans took control again in the Senate, and then with Senator Jelk on Tiffany's mining committee. And Senator Jelk and I did everything we could to point out how overreaching the Republicans are in their attempts to provide a favorable environment to one company owned by one West Virginia mining company. And I think that in the months and years ahead, you're going to see that their disregard for the Army Corps of Engineers is going to get the current law in trouble. I know they won the battle in this last biennium, but I just feel that you try to do mining in the Pinoki Hills with all that water around and, you know, upstream from some of the most pristine areas, the Army Corps of Engineers is going to nix that.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Lou on the line in Cudahy. Lou, hi.
Hi there. I have absolutely no interest in going back to field policies and the James Doyle method of leadership, where he's pilfering money from the State Highway Trust Fund to fund other stuff, and the business-unfriendly attitude of Democrats. You people seem to represent the entitlement industrial complex. My question is, what are you going to do to get the neck of government, get the boot of government off people's necks so that they can grow their business and not have government obstruct the enterprise people, the people who are the entrepreneurs. What's your plan for that?
Yeah, I don't know exactly what you're speaking of. You know, we've been living under Governor Walker for 4 years. I don't know what boot you're accusing him of putting on people's necks.
The point being, he doesn't trust Democrats to create a good business environment, worried presumably about taxes, regulation. What are your views on that? Are there cases where the government has gotten in the way of entrepreneurship in the state?
Well, I think that if you look at the Marquette poll, not the last one, but the previous one, the question was asked, who would you like to lead the state of Wisconsin, someone with solid business experience or a career politician? 60-70% of the people said the solid business experience. Mary Burke has a finance background, an MBA. She's got business experience, international business experience, Secretary of Commerce. I have complete confidence in a pro-business, pro-development attitude from Mary Burke. And if you look at her plan, Invest for Success, it's not putting the boot on anyone's neck. It's really trying to find ways in various areas around the state to pull people together and move forward in Wisconsin. So I have a lot of confidence in Mary Burke.
Talking to State Senator John Lehman, he is one of two candidates on the Democratic side of the ballot running for lieutenant governor with the primary elections on Tuesday. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is there an issue in this race you want to get the candidate's take on? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Over the last couple of weeks, Senator Lehman, one of the big back and forth issues, including in campaign ads on both sides, is the issue of outsourcing. Governor Walker's campaign accusing Mary Burke of outsourcing jobs while at Trek. Your take on that back and forth?
I think the Walker administration reads the polls like everybody else. You know, it's 47-46 likely voters in favor of Mary Burke, and I think that their ads are really very, very kind of mean and nasty and off the truth. You know, you get it's necessary for John Burke to come and say, you know, I'm not involved in politics, but don't pick on my company. Mary Burke didn't have anything to do with where the jobs are and what's developing with Trek Bicycle. Even saw Senator Johnson saying, don't pick on people for developing wealth in Wisconsin. So I think Walker's gone way beyond what he should. I think that the fact that you have a company that developed in a garage in Waterloo, Wisconsin, and has nearly 1,000 people working for it now, makes more bicycles inside the United States than any other company, speaks for itself. I think it's a phony issue. I think it's, Walker's campaign just clutching at straws.
Moving to some other policy questions. Minimum wage, should Wisconsin increase it?
Yeah, Mary Burke and I both stand for a $10.10 minimum wage. I think that we've just got to have more and more people who can, when they go to work, be able to afford then to take care of themselves and their needs and not be resting on the support of the taxpayers. And $10.10 minimum wage is a very reasonable step in that direction.
Is that something where, again, if there is a Republican-controlled legislature, or even just the Assembly, is there room for negotiation between a Democratic governor, Republican House on that issue?
Well, you look at it, and all the time I've been in the legislature, and the Democrats propose a minimum wage, and the Republicans say no. Whether or not we can get them to the point of having a reasonable discussion on minimum wage and move that minimum wage forward, you know, remains to be seen. It depends on the composition of the government, of course. But the point is, Mary Burke and the Democrats are pushing for a higher living minimum wage.
A lot of times, lieutenant governors will take on a specific issue to kind of spearhead. We mentioned the current lieutenant governor Clayfish and the jobs ambassador duties she's been fulfilling. Lieutenant Governor Lawton, you mentioned earlier, she was big on arts and education. Do you see an area that you would want to tackle and kind of put your own imprint on as lieutenant governor?
Yeah, there's a couple areas. One, of course, is anything to do with education and any educational initiatives. I'm very happy to work with. That's my, you know, personal background and where I've done most of the public policy work that I focused on in the legislature. But I have declared my willingness to work with Mary Burke and to take assignment from Mary Burke. There are various interest groups around the state that haven't been pulled into the political process enough, I'd be very willing to be her ambassador to one group or another, and to go out there and try to increase participation in the process. I certainly would be happy to take assignments in the area of jobs growth and tourism and traveling and speaking on behalf of the people of Wisconsin and the beautiful state that we have.
Back to our callers now. We've got Marianne on the line in Racine. Marianne, hi.
Hi. I am from John Layman's district, and he served us well before, and I'm glad he's there with us, and I think it would be great if he does become lieutenant governor. But my question to him is that I've seen this happen over and over and over again, where we try to recruit businesses from other states, and they get all these benefits for coming here. And the companies that have been here for years, they've been paying taxes, they've been supporting the economy, they've been giving jobs to people. They don't get anything. It goes to the person, the company that's willing to leave. And it seems like that's not very productive. Then it encourages some of our places to leave, too, because they can go to another state.
Marianne, thanks. Not too much time left. Senator Layman, your reaction?
I appreciate that question. There are numerous state programs to work with existing businesses, and Mary Burke, of course, was a leader in that area when she was Secretary of Commerce. And I think Marianne's point is very well taken. And again, if you look in Invest for Success, Mary Burke's program on economic development, you'll see a number of ways that she would like to work with existing businesses, not getting in that battle with other states.
So as you mentioned, the polls earlier, about 93-94% of the people who are going to vote in Wisconsin already know who they're going to vote for. How do you appeal to the remaining 5-8%, depending on which poll you look at?
Well, I think if you look at Mary Burke's resume and you don't know anything about her politics, she said, well, she must be a Republican business person or whatever. She has a wonderful educational background and business background, which should appeal to anybody. And she's not strident in any way. She has a good agenda, I think. But I think, Mary, the more people get to know Mary, and everybody doesn't know her as well yet, you know, we've got some work to do here, but the more people get to know Mary Burke, the happier they are, and the more they understand the depth of her understanding of business and how to move Wisconsin forward.
Senator Layman, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's John Layman. He's a Democratic state senator. He represents Wisconsin's 21st Senate District. He's one of two Democrats running in next week's primary election for lieutenant governor.
I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.